ask BBC Sounds to play that brand new podcast.
Ooh.
And you can even ask BBC Sounds to pause, rewind and restart live radio on your smart speaker. If only everything in life is that simple. For music, radio and podcasts on most smart speakers, just say, smart speaker, ask BBC Sounds.
It's midday and time for Private Passions, and Michael Barclay's guest is the photographer Sarah Lee.
Sarah Lee is a photographer who was first given a camera on her 18th birthday. She taught herself how to use it by taking photographs for the student newspaper while studying for a degree in English literature at University College London. The offer of free film and the use of a darkroom proved irresistible. Well, since then, her images, with their focus on people, have appeared in Rolling Stone, Vanity Fair, Time magazine, and many more. She's worked for the Guardian newspaper for more than 20 years and is an official photographer for the BAFTA Awards. There, she captures the likes of Nicole Kidman and Leonardo DiCaprio backstage or on the red carpet in intimate black and white shots. Sarah, we're going to hear music by Scarlatti, Mozart, Nina Simone, but I get the feeling we could easily have had a programme consisting of nothing but Bach.
Yeah, Bach sort of feels like the starting place for music for me and the anchor. Everything comes back to Bach, though I'm not a musician, so I can't wholly explain why, but it seems to fill every gap, if that doesn't sound too abstract.
And also it's such an extraordinary marriage of the cerebral and the heart, isn't it?
Yes, it feels like it answers questions. I mean, when my mother was pregnant with me, she listened to Bach repeatedly and she craved it. And I don't know if I was a parasite influencing her or if that influenced me.
So what is the first piece that we're going to hear then?
I had to choose a piece of choral music because I listened to a lot of choral music, and this, I think, is the most joyous cantata I've ever heard. I mean, I use music all the time as a sort of shortcut to feeling or a medicine even, actually, for kind of everything that sometimes ails. But this cantata feels like pure joy.
Thank you.
Cantata Jesu nun se gepreisert, the Amsterdam Baroque Chorus and Orchestra, conducted by Ton Koopman.
It's very uplifting, isn't it?
Extremely.
There are two reasons for that, Sara Lee. The first is that he wrote it for New Year's Day, and the second is it's based on a hymn, Jesu nun se gepreisert, which is all about praising.
It feels like it. I mean, sitting here is rather nerve-wracking, but listening to that is immediate balm. It's soothing. I think, oh, I know this.
You're human again.
Yeah.
Did you ever talk about music with your father, for example?
Growing up, I think it was the thing I had most in common, or have. Both my parents are still alive, but my father in particular, when I was very small and, you know, we'd be in the car, he would make me guess the composer or guess the soloist or guess the instrument.
So you would have said, oh, those are D trumpets, clearly.
No, No. I wasn't a prodigy, but I could say things like, is it an oboe? I mean, it sounds insufferable, but I enjoyed doing it. It's a connection, I suppose.
So. Well, let's move on to your instrument of work, in other words, the camera. Tell us about that one you got on your 18th birthday.
Well, actually, it was a huge disappointment. I mean, growing up, I longed to have something that I was good at, but I seemed to be bad at nearly everything. And actually, I could read well, and that's why I went to university and did literature, because it was basically the only thing I could do. And pre-tuition fees, it wasn't such an extravagance. But actually, at university, I was diagnosed as dyslexic. And to be honest, I just wanted one of those cool little Olympus point-and-presses that were fashionable at the time. And my father instead asked a friend of his who's a photographer about cameras and got me this Pentax K1000. It's a brilliant camera to learn on. It was a really great choice with a sort of 50mm lens, but it came covered in dust in a cardboard box and it couldn't have looked less like the very sexy Olympus that I had in mind. And I thought, well, I'm bound to fail at that. But actually, it was explained to me how it worked and the penny dropped really quickly. I thought, no, I can do this. And, you know, the film came back and it wasn't a disaster. And I think, you know, photography is three different ways of regulating light, technically. So your aperture, your shutter speed and your film speed, as was now, it would be ISO. And from using just that camera a lot for about 4 years, it became sort of absolute second nature to control those three things. I love photography. I really found my thing.
One of the first photographs that I think drew attention to your work was of Iris Murdoch.
Oh, gosh. It's very rare to have moments in life where you know at the time, and certainly with hindsight, that your life has pivoted on something. And I took a portrait of Iris Murdoch, and that basically gave me my career. When I was a student, I worked as a researcher for Peter Conradi, but it meant that I had this sort of Iris Murdoch sideline going on. And she was a novelist who I adored, and I'd read all her novels, and I was a fan and, you know, thrilled to be having any connection to this biography. She announced that she had Alzheimer's, but very early days after that announcement, she was still doing readings and book festivals and things with her husband, the literary critic John Bailey. And I had the opportunity to photograph her. I was so nervous, I exposed the film incorrectly. I exposed it as if it was 400. Actually, it was 200, and I had to develop it myself and do the chemistry. But anyway, the pictures came out, and they were easily the strongest work I'd done at that point. I mean, it's hard to put your finger on, but maybe it is that I was very immersed in her world biographically and the world of her fiction. You know, I had maybe a maturity of understanding at that time with that subject that possibly I wouldn't have done in general with other subjects. I think she gave me the picture, actually, and she was certainly compos mentis enough to consent. And you do sometimes with subjects, they choose to give you something. It's like they choose to open a door of connection in some way. And it's like a gift. And maybe I was a very young, nervous, rather starstruck photographer, and it's possible that she was just being very kind. Later, I met Eamon McCabe, the Guardian's picture editor, And he said, well, show us if you've got any pictures in your portfolio. And I didn't even know what a portfolio was, let alone have one. But I did sort of show him the Iris Murdoch, and he was really astonished and said, well, how did you get that? And it turned out his favourite shoot he'd done that year had been of Iris Murdoch, and he liked my picture. And actually, I can say now, 25 years later, it's still a good picture. And he just said, why don't you start at The Guardian next week? 2 days, we'll see how it goes. And that was 24 years ago.
Handel next.
This is another connection possibly to my father, in that Handel is his Bach. I think it's a shortcut to this wonderful lost world of Georgian England. And I feel the same. I picture that Peter Greenaway-ish draftsman's contract, kind of Peter Capaldi in a frock coat, leaping through a maze. I like the imagery you get listening to Handel, but this particular Concerto Grosso, I think I first heard it in a terrible, terrible Derek Jacobi, Oliver Reed horror film. It was so awful. I'm really sorry. And I love both their work, but it was called Blue Blood. And it was all filmed at Longleat, actually. So it sort of fitted with this beautiful piece of music. And I've loved it ever since.
The Concerto Grosso in B-flat, Opus 3, No. 2 by Handel, from which that was the Largo, Les Musiciens du Louvre, conducted by Mark Minkowski. Do you find that music helps with your work?
Yes, I listen to music all the time, but often photographers in studios, music is used very much as an aid to the shoot. Now, it doesn't really work for me on location or outside, but yet, I work in a very fluid way. I mean, I always carry a camera with me. I think I've had one with me now. And I don't see much of a dividing line between what I'm commissioned to do and what is my job and what is genuinely a vocation, really. Photography, it's a continuous thing. I want to be better. I hope I'm not as good as I might one day be. I'm always striving. And it's a continual daily practice. And I think that's quite similar to a musician.
Yes, it is. I mean, and I think in music that the day you think you've got there is the day to stop.
Yeah, I would imagine. And actually, before any job, I'm extremely nervous. And I think there are similarities in that to performance. And music takes us out of ourselves. We're so wrapped up in our own heads that I think any art form, we read, we watch plays, we listen to music. And maybe this goes back to my student-y love of Iris Murdoch, but it's all about realising that other people are real. That she would put it that they, something other than oneself is real. That's what photography does, or portrait photography. You're making that emotional engagement with the subject.
Well, in your most recent series of work, Tender Are the Nighthawks, all the shots are taken between the hours of 2 a.m. and 4 a.m. What was the starting point for this?
Well, I'm an owl who tends to be very awake at night and terrible in the morning. I felt very sort of guilty and sort of, you feel slightly ashamed being awake at 3 a.m. when you shouldn't be. And I thought, well, why don't I, a few years ago, do something with this, actually, rather than fretting. So with this, I was photographing just late at night people out on the street that I saw. And then I realised it was the journeys, that bit when the city people are going wherever they are going for the final point that night, you know, parties or clubs or their night out. There's a lot of young people. But there are also, you know, one of the photographs, it was a bus full of women in white. And I put on Facebook afterwards, you know, what's going on here? And someone said, oh, it's Ethiopian or Eritrean New Year, and it's women who've been visiting different churches, and you do it right through the, almost through the night, but they would be going home at this point. And I love seeing London, you know, my city that I live in, and seeing it from a different viewpoint.
There's a very strong natural feel about that, the girl sleeping against a window, and I wonder whether there's something about the innocence of the people you're posing, in as much as you're not posing them. They're just there.
I suppose it's what I'm interested in. I mean, when I do portraits, I feel very responsible and very tender towards all subjects, even people who, you know, I photograph politicians or who I vehemently disagree with. But I find that the subject is vulnerable. I mean, there's a reason I hate it when someone points a camera at me. It makes me feel terribly exposed and I think I must look horrible. But it is exposing to photograph someone, whether they know you're doing it or not. Actually, in this series was mainly candid.
So you didn't need to get permission, as it were, from them?
No. I mean, the law in Britain is if you don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy, anyone can be photographed anywhere. It depends how it's published. But I didn't tell them beforehand that I was photographing them, because then you lose the moment. Often people, if they can read your intentions, pose or pout or give me a thumbs up, which I couldn't be less keen to photograph. So often I will do what I want and then explain to them afterwards. Mm. I have to say, every photograph in that series where I've asked someone, that they have been fine with it.
How many photographs might you take on one of these nocturnal journeys?
If I got 4 strong images, I would be absolutely delighted. I mean, I'd really be delighted with 1 is enough. I mean, I work on a manual focus rangefinder, so it's got nothing automatic about it, although it reads onto a digital chip rather than a piece of celluloid film. And I do that deliberately. I like being slowed down. But it means that you can't shoot from the hip. I'm standing a metre away from the person and I'm holding a camera to my face. It's unambiguous.
The next piece is all about seizing the moment. Nina Simone.
I think this is currently, anyway, my favourite piece of music. I love Nina Simone. She's a sort of goddess and rightly regarded as such. Late one night when I should have been asleep but was awake at 2 a.m, I came across this and it kind of blew my mind. She's performing here with Al Shachtman, a guitarist who she collaborated with for decades, and double bass player Chris White. And I particularly like the understanding that seems to exist between her and Shachtman. They start extemporizing, and it's like a Bach fugue, but in the middle of a joyous Nina Simone jazz composition. And the lyrics, it's, you know, we could all be dead tomorrow.
Yes, for all we know, we may never meet again. Before we go, make this moment live again.
It's wonderful. She's not wrong.
For all we know,
Well, Sarah, I think you have continued the Bach idea throughout the programme, because the counterpoint in that is very like Bach, isn't it?
As you say. I snuck another one in on the list.
It's a beautiful song.
The kind of melancholy of it, that we are all doomed, but for all we know, we could be gone tomorrow, so we have to make the best of it. I mean, I love it. But also, I read a little bit about Nina Simone and how heartbreaking it was for her. When she first played Carnegie Hall, she said she wished she'd been there playing Bach, because she was obviously classically trained and racial politics being what they were. But I love that she did play Bach at Carnegie Hall. It's in My Baby Just Cares For Me. It's there.
Nina Simone singing For All We Know live in New York in 1961. When you were growing up in the West Midlands and you were sent to a boarding school, but did you learn an instrument at all?
I didn't. I was offered the choice of, I don't quite know why this choice was presented this way, piano lessons or judo lessons. And I chose judo, but I was terrible at that. I had one match and I got really squashed. And that was the end of that. My career as a martial artist was very short-lived and I can't play the piano. I mean, you could be at a Queen concert of everyone clapping to We Will Rock You at Wembley Stadium and I'd be the one clapping off the beat. I just don't have it, the thing. I wish I did. I would long for it, but I've obviously got ears. I can listen to it.
So how come you chose the Scarlatti? Does that go back quite a long time?
We had a piano at home and my father played the piano, but he didn't have a terribly wide repertoire. He'd come back from work and I left to go to school when I was seven, so I was quite young, this, but he had a couple of pieces he played, and this is the one that I remember the most. I don't know which is better for the memory, music or smell, as a kind of mnemonic prompt, but for some reason it's the summer in my mind's eye. I can picture him in a pinstripe suit, possibly smoking a cigarette at the same time, playing it, and I'm sitting on the floor.
Thank you. I love the way it goes up the hill and then just sort of falls over the top.
Sounds, is it people marching? I can't, it's got that very
insistent.
Yes,
that as well.
Yeah. It very much sums up my father, and I hear his personality in it.
Scarlatti's Keyboard Sonata in E Major, played by Yuzhe Wang. We talked about Sara Lee, your work on the streets in the middle of the night. let's talk a little...
Yes.
Can we talk a little bit about when you're not being a night owl? Because you were once sent to photograph the former Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. What was the nature of that commission?
Oh, gosh. That was quite early in my Guardian career. And I went with Emma Brox, a brilliant writer. And it was not long after 9/11... Sharon wanted to give an interview that emphasised that he was fighting a war on terror as well. I think that was the point of it. But I remember we sat in a sort of living room, I suppose, but we kept waiting there for quite a while. I think it was an impression was made. His large Alsatian, which was called Schwarz, came in and ate this pile of cakes that Emma and I didn't realise whether the cakes were for us, were they for someone else? We weren't sure, so we weren't touching the cakes. So the interview began with him furious at this Alsatian covered in cream, which was oddly comic.
And you picked fruit with him.
We did pick
fruit.
In
a field of bulls?
The field of bulls was next to the fruit, so we went in a kind of armoured Land Rover, and the armour plating means that the doors are so thick that there didn't seem to be a lot of room, and we sat squashed in. And one of my favourite things of working with writers is just you're having the first-person experience, and there's something addictive about that. The thing that other people will be reading, you're living. And I like sometimes catching the writer's eye and thinking, what are we doing? And being squashed in the back of an armoured Land Rover to go fruit-picking with Ariel Sharon was definitely a moment.
One of the photographs, it's nice to give an idea of them, shows Sharon in jeans and a denim shirt, standing in a dusty field with a single brown cow in the background. So rather far from the usual image of suited leaders in corridors of power.
He was very keen, I think, to show us that he was a farmer. And in that instance, you know when you're being led to create an impression. I mean, you know, any decent journalist understands the game of this. And then we went to this field, and he said, there were bulls. And I thought, well, are we OK in the field of bulls? So I went in with him, and I did cross my mind, what if a bull does? I looked over my shoulder. There was someone had a grenade launcher on one shoulder. I mean, the security for this casual moment was quite... I thought, I'm perfectly safe. If a bull had charged, I think it would have been dealt with.
Do you think when you're out photographing people, they are aware about the power of an image? I mean, after all, one of your photographs of Hannah Bardell, the SNP member, was actually chosen for National Portrait Gallery. So they live on, don't they?
People are very aware now. I mean, I wish that I had been born 30 years earlier, really, to do my career as a photographer, because it was a different landscape, a much more naive landscape, really. Now, people in public life, they probably have, you know, a seminar where they spend half a day learning about the power of the image. And for people like me, it makes our life much harder because there's a resistance and a tension, which is understood. And even on the street, you asked about permission and things. You know, when the great masters of 20th century reportage street photography were working, there was much less awareness. You know, something like more photographs are probably being taken this morning than were taken in the whole of the first half of the 20th century, you know, globally. I mean,
it's an amazing
thing. We all have cameras. So it's getting that dance between making the subject feel safe and also catching something that they may not have known that they were going to give you or may not have wanted to give you, but that I make the decision as the person with my finger on the shutter is what I want to say and how I want to present that relationship between me and them.
The next music I sang as a choir boy, where did you come across it?
I find something very, very comforting in choral music, and I realised that I didn't have any Mozart, and it seemed crazy to be on this programme without having at least one piece of Mozart, and it's transcendently beautiful. you were saying that you'd sung that piece, but there was a point where you just went, oof, and it was exactly the same point that I was oofing. And how does that work? I don't understand it. I haven't sung it. That's magic.
Mozart's Ave Verum Corpus. We heard the Vienna Boys Choir and Chorus Viennensis with the Vienna Folks Opera Orchestra, conducted by Peter Marschik. Now, 11 years ago, Sara Lee, you embarked on a project with another Guardian writer, Laura Barton, which involved walking in the USA. It's called Sunrise to Sunset. What did you do?
Well, it was about 11 years ago, and I felt I'd rather lost my way as a photographer a bit, actually. It had become a job, and something that people tell you a lot, but you know, the penny hadn't dropped, is do your own work. Your own work and your own practice feeds back into your professional life. And I thought, well, let's give this a go. I'm actually even on the verge of stopping doing this as a profession. And I was going to California anyway, and I thought, I'd love to walk down Sunset Boulevard, which is a place I like in LA, from sunrise to sunset. Why not? And I just do it as an exercise in photo reportage, a kind of shoot for me, wholly. And Laura is a writer who I've worked with. I mean, we both started at sort of age 22 at The Guardian at the same time. I used to get given all the worst jobs, you know, the box pops in Euston Station at 7 a.m. and the things no one else wanted to do. And she was keen. She loves California. And we did it over 2 days. So we started at sort of dawn, finished at dusk. Laura wrote a beautiful piece. And then we thought, well, let's do our road trip on foot through a number of American cities. And we did sort of several more. And as she was sort of sitting on the project, we may come back to it.
You're a keen surfer, aren't you, talking of California?
I'm a really, really keen surfer. And I notice you say keen, not good. And because there's a massive... I don't know, if you'd seen me, I'm a terrible surfer. I had a surf instructor who said that I had the least natural ability but the most determination. It just seemed sort of, you know, like riding unicorns or something. It's so unlikely that I would be able to do it. My husband said, well, go and have lessons. And sort of got caught in a riptide on the first day. I'd not even swum in the sea for 20 years before that. I was the kind of person who didn't like it if seaweed touched my foot. I've seen sharks in the sea whilst I've been in there. I had completely changed. I love it so much.
It was while surfing that you dreamt up the project, West of West.
Yes. Actually, a book that Laura Barton, my great collaborator friend, wrote the foreword for, at the risk of sounding like a Point Break wannabe. You have to paddle past where the waves break to sit on what's known as the lineup, where you're sitting sort of really waiting for the right wave to come along. And you're sitting on, you know, basically a flotation device, looking back at the shore and thinking, gosh, it's the edge of America. More or less nothing behind you but Japan. So after every time I went surfing, I would go off with my camera and see if anything came.
There are photos taken on Santa Monica Pier. A boy with a giant donut over his head surveys a beach full of people sunbathing and swimming. So it's the same the world over, in a way, isn't it?
There's something very unifying about being under the sun. And gradually I realised that I was really interested in a modern version of frontierism. People had come across to the West. People were tourists. A lot of people had gone to the coast because they'd fallen through all the cracks in America. You know, they had no social care, no health care. I'd talked to people and they'd gone there to be bums, the American word, but they'd spent their last money on a ticket there because if you're going to be homeless, it's better to do it in the sun. You get millionaires, you get your tech people who work for Tesla, you've got your wealthy tourists, and it's all sort of, you know, people take their shoes and socks off and that kind of humanity.
I only had one disappointment when I went there. When I went into the sea, I thought it would be warmer.
Fool!
So
it's
you
freezing.
Presumably surf in a wetsuit.
Usually, yes. I mean, there is a couple of months in the year when it does kind of warm up, but no, it's not that warm.
Well, the next piece was recorded up the coast in San Francisco at a legendary club called Fillmore West. Tell me about this.
I never saw King Curtis play live, but I love White A Shade of Pale, which, again, I realise is a way of sneaking Bach back in, since Procol Harum borrowed heavily from Bach. And I do like that kind of nutty, of-its-time 60s version with the incomprehensible lyrics. But then I heard this, possibly for the first time, in Withnail and I. It's elegiac, the kind of grimness of Camden Town at its grubbiest, but its most magical. And I've lived in Camden Town for 20 years, and that struck a chord. But it's just something I love. Thank you.
wonderful to hear that piece on the saxophone. King Curtis with his version of A Whiter Shade of Pale. It was recorded in 1971. And the awful thing is that shortly afterwards, Curtis was stabbed to death outside his apartment in New York City.
I didn't know that about King Curtis. I don't know very much at all biographically about him, but it's magic, the recording. He lives on the recording.
Something very much about the live recording, which I think is there, isn't it?
You can sort of smell the smoke, hear the whoops. I love that kind of analogue imperfection and life breaking through. It's lovely to hear.
Sara Lee, you're an official photographer for BAFTA and their awards ceremonies, which means that you get to go on the red carpet and also behind the scenes. You described the experience of being on the red carpet as trying to find a connection against the odds in the middle of what feels like a beautifully dressed, well-organised riot. So how do you find that connection? Do you look for things which are slightly bizarre, almost?
I mean, I've never hunted or fished or anything, but I think you go on instinct. I mean, there's so much noise, literally, because you've got lots of fans shouting, you've got 60 television crews, and there's a lot of people. And I've been very fortunate that BAFTA have just given me free rein, and it's heaven. I'm a lurker, and what I'm looking for, that kind of human connection and intimacy at this very public event.
And, but you shoot in black and white, don't you, on those
I do, and I use my sort of Leica rangefinder, and so I make it hard for myself because people are moving and I'm having to do manual focus. But when you nail it, it's so much more satisfying. I mean, there are other photographers there, and I see the brilliantly successful photographer called Greg Williams, who I work with there. He is a very alpha male, and these giants of cinema and screen, they bow down to him. And I was just thinking, well, how can I? I'm not even a beta female. How on earth can I? And I realised we all do different things. And I am a quiet lurker. If I can be invisible, that they don't notice.
You actually bowed down to Julianne Moore, didn't you? I don't know that you meant to.
I think this may have been the first year I did it. So I was incredibly nervous. And I was in the auditorium, and it was in the minutes before the televised broadcast started. And Julianne Moore was in the front row, and she was in superb light. And actually, she gave me the shot. She didn't look at me or make eye contact, but she knew I was there, and I saw her do what the very best actors can do. She turned herself on. It was like the light came on behind her eyes, the Garbo light. And it's so indefinable, but you know it when you see it. And then I knelt down to take the shot, and I knelt hard on her foot, which was unfortunate. But she was a pro, and she still let me take the photo.
You've often worked with musicians like Coldplay, indeed, and with David Gilmour from Pink Floyd. In fact, you worked with him in 2016 when he returned to perform at Pompeii 45 years after Pink Floyd filmed a live set there in the amphitheatre. That must have been amazing.
Yeah, Pompeii was extraordinary. I mean, it was a really fantastic privilege to be invited to shoot those concerts. And for anyone who doesn't know, I think Pink Floyd did a film there in the early 70s. But there hadn't been an audience there since AD 79 and Vesuvius going off. And you really felt ghosts stirring. I mean, the audience, because it's unstable, Pompeii, around the edges, the audience was in the sort of arena. But I did go up to the top at the back. The music started as the sun set, and you could see Vesuvius kind of behind. And really, it wasn't a great stretch to imagine ghosts.
You might think that Pink Floyd would manage to make Vesuvius erupt again.
Well, they sort of did. They have a fantastic lighting designer, a man called Mark Brickman, who's the artist in residence for the Empire State Building and things like that, so really knows how to light something dramatically. There was red light around the top. It felt like you were in the volcano. I mean, it was extraordinary. And being a photographer, any photographer will tell you, it's a champagne lifestyle on kind of beer and chips money. But it's amazing. I mean, I have an interesting, that's all I wanted was an interesting life. And that's what it gives you.
We began with Bach, Sara Lee, and we're going to end with Bach.
Glenn Gould, Fugue in E minor. I'd say I listen to this more than any other piece of music, and I don't know if I can mention Spotify, but I have one huge playlist. It must have about 3,000 tracks in it, that whenever there's something I like, I just add it. But this is the first one on that list, so it always defaults to this. So I must listen to this a couple of times a day, and I never, ever get bored of it.
It only remains for me, Sara Lee, to say thank you very much. It's been fascinating talking about images and imagery and music. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Glenn Gould playing Bach's Prelude and Fugue No. 10 in E minor, the final choice of Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions, the photographer Sarah Lee. Today's episode was produced by Claire Walker, and next week Michael's guest will be the novelist Kit Duval. BBC Radio 3 on 90 to 93 FM, digital radio, BBC Sounds, and on most smart speakers. Just ask for BBC Radio 3. It's 1 o'clock, time for the news by me, Jane Steele. The British Retail Consortium has said that government plans for supermarkets to introduce a voluntary price cap on some basic food items, like milk and bread, won't make a jot of difference, while other costs remain high. Ministers will discuss the agreement with major retailers as part of efforts to tackle the rising cost of living. The secular challenger in Turkey's presidential runoff election, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, has urged citizens to go to the ballot boxes and, as he put it, get rid of oppression and the authoritarian regime. The incumbent, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, urged his supporters not to be complacent as he cast his ballot in Istanbul. The Health Secretary, Steve Barclay, has acknowledged some of the 40 new hospitals promised by the government will be refurbished sites rather than built from scratch. Mr. Barclay also confirmed for the first time that not all of the work would be completed by the 2030 deadline. Ukraine says Russia's overnight drone assault on Kyiv was the biggest since its invasion began. Officials said 40 out of the 54 drones targeted the capital. One man was killed by falling debris. Most of the drones over Kyiv were shot down. President Zelensky has praised Ukraine's air defence forces and rescue services, saying every time drones and missiles were intercepted, lives were saved. Devon and Cornwall police say that two men in their 20s have died after being pulled from the water off the coast of Torbay. One of them was declared dead at the scene and the second man died after being taken to hospital. The Home Office is launching an advertising campaign on Facebook and Instagram to deter people in Albania from trying to come to the UK in small boats. The ads warn would-be migrants that they will be detained and removed. Two Just Stop Oil protesters who interrupted yesterday's rugby premiership final at Twickenham have been charged with aggravated trespass. Simon Johnson, who's 40, and 37-year-old Patrick Hart threw orange powder onto the pitch, which briefly brought the game to a halt. They will appear in court in London tomorrow. Four MPs have been told to repay hundreds of pounds after claiming driving fines on their expenses. The government minister, Amanda Soloway, two Tory MPs and an SNP MP put through the claims. The Independent Parliamentary Standards Authority said its checks had failed in some cases and it had wrongly covered penalty charges and fines. The weather, any cloud will tend to break with sunshine developing for many this afternoon. It will be mostly dry. BBC News and weather at 1:02 past 1.
Expand your horizons with Radio 3's classical mixtape. Each day, Radio 3 brings you a 30-minute soundscape of classical favourites, mixed with jazz, folk, and music from around the world. Take time out with our specially curated classical mixtape every day.